For decades, the name Tammany Hall was synonymous with corruption and greed. Journalists, religious leaders, and reformers labeled its members the scum of the earth, un-American, stupid, and lazy. Yet Tammany also fostered and inspired ambitious social reforms that paved the way for a modern America. Dozens of mayors, governors, even presidents made their way through the rough and tumble of Tammany Hall. So why did the shady reputations of people like Boss Tweed and Carmine DiSapio endure while Franklin Roosevelt's did not? Terry Galway tells the story of how American politics was once ruled by the 99% in his book, Machine Made, Tammany Hall and the Creation of Modern American Politics. It is published by Liveright, and Terry Galway joins us now. Welcome back to our show.
Thank you.
Tammany Hall doesn't just refer to a building. It refers to a political organization. So maybe we should begin with a brief history of it. It was founded pretty much in the earliest days of our country.
It was. It was a private organization founded by people who found the Federalist Party of George Washington and John Adams to be very elitist. And so this was founded to sort of counter that as a sort of anti-aristocratic organization. And then somebody by the name of Aaron Burr and others thought, well, we have this block of people. Why don't we convert them into a political faction? And that faction, the Society of Tammany, became the ruling faction of the Democratic Party.
Well, Aaron Burr turns out to be one of the more complicated
yes.
figures in American history. But does he put a taint on it from the start?
Well, certainly some people would think that. And Burr is, as you suggest, a complicated factor. But you know,
well, he was a vice president.
He was a vice president. He also murdered the Treasury Secretary, Alexander Hamilton.
And was accused of treason at a certain point.
And probably was a traitor. But, do you know, my interest in Tammany Hall actually takes the story a little bit more into the 19th century when the Irish immigrants begin coming and transforming it.
Well, how did it wind up being named Tammany, which comes out of the Lenape Indians?
Yes.
And there's a lot of Indian stuff
yes.
attached
yes.
to Tammany Hall.
Well, weirdly, I think, the founders of the Tammany Society felt that the true egalitarian American, the contrast to, say, John Adams, who has a bad rap, he really wasn't that much of an elitist, but they felt the Native Americans were sort of the quintessential egalitarian American. So there was this chief called Tammany or Tamamend, and so they named their society after this chief. And as you suggest, in fact, right around the corner, there's the Huron Club, which is now a theater. The Huron Club was one of Tammany's clubhouses, and it was the clubhouse of Jimmy Walker.
And Tammany Hall was on 14th Street and
right.
Park Avenue South.
It was
the original one.
The original one, that's right. And there's one still to this day on Union Square East and 17th Street.
And you mentioned that you're most interested in the time when the Irish immigrants started coming in. Its critics have considered the worst of urban politics, but that's because they weren't all that impressed by the fact that Tammany was helping people like the Irish immigrants?
I think so. There was, you know, in 19th century New York, and bear in mind, you know, the city today proudly considers itself to be a bastion of toleration. No Irish immigrant in 1847 would have ever agreed with that statement. So what I tried to do is interpret the Tammany story through the Irish American experience, which is my area of expertise, to try to figure out why the Irish were so attracted to this society and then how they reorganized their lives and then achieved social change.
Well, which came first, the Irish attraction to Tammany or Tammany's wooing of these new immigrants?
Absolutely, Tammany's wooing of these new immigrants. As they were coming, we're now talking about the famine generation of Irish immigrants, those hundreds of thousands who came to New York with nothing but the clothes on their back. Now, of course, today we consider that a cliche. In 1845, this generation of immigrants was a new experience. These people had no skills. They came from farms. They were Catholic, and they were poor. So
the Protestant elite found them threatening?
Threatening. They felt that they were un-American. They felt that their allegiance to the Pope made them impossible to assimilate. So the Whig Party, which was the dominant party in the 1840s, rejected these immigrants, said that they could not be assimilated. Tammany Hall, on the other hand, presumed no judgments and welcomed them.
I assume at a certain point the Whigs or the successors realized that they probably needed those new votes as well. So did they go after them too?
Not really. I mean, I would argue that the first reformer, and he was more of a Republican, I suppose, but the first reformer, Seth Lowe, who was elected mayor in 1901, he was really the first anti-Tammany public official to suggest what you just did. Let's go out and reach out into these groups. But before that, nobody did.
Well, wasn't there a boat race to Staten Island in January 1871?
There was, and that was during the Tweed era. And that, mind you, that yes, that's true. That was a case where there was a Republican boat and there was a Tammany boat. And off Staten Island, off the quarantine station, were five Irish immigrants who were famous in their day. They were Irish rebels. They had been released from prison. So you had the Tammany faction of the Democratic Party and the Republican boat racing out to Staten Island to see who would be the first to welcome them to the city. But that was a rare event for the Republican Party.
My guest is Terry Galway, who has been covering Irish immigrant issues and related matters for many years now. His latest book is called Machine Made, Tammany Hall and the Creation of Modern American Politics. It's published by Liveright. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Describe the power structure of Tammany. How was it organized?
Well, you know, it was very much organized like the Catholic Church. And several observers well before me saw that comparison. You had a boss. He is essentially, we would call him today, the chairman of the party, who was elected by his executive council. And then you had
the cardinals.
The cardinals, exactly, right. And then you had the parish priests who did the brunt of the work. And they were the district leaders. They were the people we call ward healers. There was one on every block. There was one in every tenement.
Well, was this conscious? Was Tammany a Catholic organization?
Well, many people accused it of being that. There certainly were ties between, say, John Kelly, who was the first Irish Catholic boss of Tammany. He came into office after Tweed was overthrown, and he was married to the niece of Cardinal McCloskey, who was the leading Catholic clergyman. And certainly Tammany became a conspicuously Catholic organization for the next 100 years.
But Tweed also was wooing Catholics, wasn't he?
He was. That's true. Because he saw that he could count. I mean, many of the things that you have to understand about Tammany Hall is that they were very practical people. And he realized that the fastest growing population were Catholics. So he definitely courted them.
You say that Tammany helped the poor and marginalized in different ways than the charity groups did.
Yes.
And that was important to the people in need.
That was very important because, you know, the predominant tradition among the voluntary aid organizations, all of which were certainly good, pure of heart people, but they had this notion that you had to prove that you were worthy of assistance. And Tammany, frankly, didn't care if you were worthy of assistance. If you came for help, you got it. And I sort of take that story back to the Irish famine, where starving people were asked to prove if they were worthy of government assistance.
But couldn't it also be seen as buying votes and buying loyalty?
Sure. And it worked both ways. But the point is, if you are friendless, if you are hungry, if you're jobless in New York and somebody extends a hand to you, you're going to take that hand.
And you're right. The Irish knew that without power, they might be left to starve in the name of abstract ideology. Now, the Irish also became important politically in Boston. But was the process all that different there?
The process was a little different there because the machine was more personal in the sense that it was, I mean, the most famous machine in Boston was the Curley machine, which existed from the 19-teens all the way to the 1940s. But I think that the basic way it operated was very similar in the sense that, you know, it was a transaction. It was a social welfare system before there was a social welfare system, so that, yes, you would receive help, but you were also expected to vote the straight party ticket on election day.
Why was it so important for Irish Catholic Americans to abolish the test oath?
Well, that goes back to the anti-Catholicism at the founding of our republic. And here in New York, there was an oath until 1809 or so, where if you were to hold a public office, you were asked to take an oath, which in essence required you to renounce the Pope, that you would not be loyal to any foreign, you know, dignitaries. And that was taken directly from the British experience. I mean, that was how the British disenfranchised the majority population of Ireland. So there's a lot of transatlantic stuff going on in this book where the Irish sort of see the same enemy here in New York that they saw in British-occupied Ireland.
A tour guide named Kevin has called in. He said actually Tammany was on Spruce Street from 1798 to 1812.
In the early stages, yes.
Yeah, then it moved to Nassau and then only moved uptown later.
And it opened on 14th Street in 1868, just in time for the Democratic National Convention.
And the Civil War.
And post-Civil War. Right.
But and it played a role in Civil War politics in New York as well, didn't it?
It did, from a very practical perspective. During the draft riots in 1863, the draft was suspended. Of course, the draft riots were the result of racism, and they were the result of classism as well. As most people, I think, know, you could have bought your way out of the draft, as Teddy Roosevelt's father did, but as most poor immigrants could not. So after the riots were quelled, and the Lincoln administration told New York, we've suspended the draft for now, but you'd better get your act together. So there were two ways to approach it. Samuel Tilden, who would later run for president, suggested that New York bring a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the draft. Tweed had a different idea. He said, well, why don't we just pay the $300? We'll borrow the money and pay $300 to anybody who wants out of the draft. And that's how peace was restored to the streets of New York.
Well, Tilden set up the Tilden Commission later.
He did.
Tilden, I only know Tilden as somebody whose name is on a number of different things here in New York, like Seth Lowe. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me he was almost in cahoots with the nativists, the people who were anti-immigrant.
He tried to triangulate that relationship. There's no question. He was a member of Tammany Hall. I mean, I found correspondence between Tilden and Tweed where they're basically talking about jobs and favors. But when he became governor in New York, he established, as you suggested, the Tilden Commission, which came back with a recommendation that the poor be disenfranchised, that if you're going to be allowed to vote in your municipal elections, you have to own property.
But wasn't that a popular sentiment at the time? We have the Know Nothing Party and other nativist groups,
yes,
all anti-immigrant. And that goes all the way into the 20th century where, if I remember correctly, some member of Congress complained that all these new immigrants, the ones from Southern Europe, the Irish and also the Jews, all had low IQs because they were scoring low on tests that they were given in English.
Correct. I mean, there's a social Darwinism piece of this that was absent, of course, at Tammany Hall. Tammany Hall didn't care about IQ tests. They cared about whether you got out the vote and whether you were a loyal party man. But certainly here in the North, we think of the Reconstruction era as disenfranchising blacks in the South and how terrible, obviously, that was. Well, the same forces were at work in the North, except they were defeated.
Now, Tammany also attracted privileged people.
It did.
Because they saw it as a power base?
Yes.
Or because they were more liberal
I think a little bit of both. Just as today's Democratic Party, which, of course, talks about, the 99% and the 1%, and we sort of have this new sort of populism in the Democratic Party, which attracts fairly wealthy Democrats. I think that people like August Belmont and others saw Tammany as the dominant faction and said, okay, well, we're going to do our deals with Tammany Hall. But I do think there was an element of ideology at work with some of these wealthier Tammany people.
And, of course, Belmont got a whole bunch of things named after him as well.
Yes, that's correct.
Terry Galway's book, Machine Made, Tammany Hall and the Creation of Modern American Politics, is published by Liveright. We're going to take a little break when we come back. We're going to talk about Boss Tweed.
Good.
We are back with Terry Galway. His latest book, Machine Made, Tammany Hall and the Creation of Modern American Politics, published by Liveright. If you say Tammany Hall to most people, the first thing that comes to mind, if they are of a certain generation, is Boss Tweed. If they're of another generation, it's a man you talk very little about here, Carmine DiSapio.
Correct. And I would argue that they are precisely the wrong images that should come to mind. I don't understand, frankly, why the first two images are not Al Smith and Robert Wagner.
Who both came out of Tammany.
Both were Tammany Hall members. Smith, arguably the greatest governor of the 20th century in New York, and Senator Wagner, clearly one of the great senators in American history.
But even Carmine DiSapio, despite his shortcomings, he supported the Fair Employment Practices Law, the New York City rent control laws, lowering of the voting age to 18. So he was supporting things that that many liberals would have also supported.
Well, this is precisely the point, and this, it's why I wrote this book, because I feel that the image of Tammany Hall needs some complexity.
So Boss Tweed was not all evil? There's a positive side to him?
Well, he certainly is the greatest villain in my book and in any book about Tammany Hall. But
he's also a hero in this book.
He is a bit of a hero in the sense that he came up with a practical way to avoid more violence during the draft, during the Civil War. He was a champion of New York City at a time when Albany wanted to exert more home rule power over the city. Some of the bribe money that he collected here in New York was then transferred to upstate legislators who would vote for New York City interests only because Tweed was paying him off. But, you know, I do think that he is a far more complicated fellow than, say, the images that Thomas Nast may have drawn of him, which are certainly obviously very one-dimensional.
But you say that Thomas Nast was also anti-Irish Catholic immigrant.
Well, there's no – I mean, it's clear in his drawings what he thinks of Irish Catholics. He draws bishops as alligators. He draws the Irish man as an ape. And I think that sort of speaks for itself.
Tweed was not Irish.
Tweed was a Scots Presbyterian.
So he is in a sense, he is he's going against his own group.
He is, but of course.
But he sees this as an opportunity to wield political power or to just enrich himself?
A little bit of both. And remember, he was also a hero from the streets of New York. I mean, he gained his fame as a fire chief, as a volunteer fire chief, you know, working the streets of New York in his red shirt, and it sort of became a celebrity that way. I think that he was interested in the politics, raw politics and power, but he also found it a way to get rich through politics.
And eventually paid for it.
Yes.
Was Charlie Murphy his successor?
No. There was Kelly, and then there was Richard Croker, who sort of was from the Tweed School of Political Operations. And then Charlie Murphy becomes the boss in 1902 and remains the boss to his death in 1924. And I would argue the greatest and most interesting boss of all of Tammany Hall's bosses.
Well, you say he was the best Tammany boss, but he still suffered enormous criticism.
He did. Well, first of all, he made enemies of people like William Randolph Hearst. And Hearst's newspapers portrayed him as wearing prisoner's stripes. One of the reasons he was controversial is that he lost elections. You know, there's this notion that Tammany stole elections. And I would argue that they probably stole an 1886 mayoralty and probably the 1905 election when Hearst was running for mayor, and that election probably was stolen. But Murphy also suffered devastating defeats in the 1913 mayoral race when John Proy Mitchell, the boy mayor, was elected, and he lost a gubernatorial election. So there were calls for his dismissal, not because he was corrupt, but because they thought he was ineffective.
But I assume also because Tammany Hall had come to represent everything that was bad in politics. And so if you wanted to run as a reformer, you said, I'm against Tammany Hall.
Correct. And Murphy himself ran against Tammany Hall early in his career.
He also helped transform the Democratic Party from the party of William Jennings Bryan and the party, at least in the North, the party that had sympathies toward the South, had connections to the KKK.
Correct. One of the great transformations that Tammany was in the forefront of in the Democratic Party was this transformation of a party that was Southern and Western into a nativist, really, at its core. I mean, William Jennings Bryan was a nativist, to a party of North, Eastern, and Midwestern ethnics, meaning Catholics and Jews. Tammany was in the forefront of that transformation, and that was what made the Democratic Party the modern 20th century party that it became.
So its reach extended past New York City?
Murphy was a national political broker. There's no question, because New York, we forget this because New York's power has sort of deteriorated over the last 40 years, but New York was the political colossus of the United States from 1910 until around 1960.
How did the Triangle Fire of 1911 represent a milestone for Tammany Hall?
Well, of course, it's a milestone in American history because it's the fire that caused this great outrage in 1911 when more than 140 young women, mostly Jews and Italians, were killed in a terrible fire, the result of negligence on the part of the owners. And after the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, Robert Wagner and Al Smith, two young Tammany members, were put in charge of an investigative committee to look into workforce abuses in New York. And they used that opportunity to not only suggest things like fire escapes, but also to set in motion reforms like workers' compensation, like child labor laws. And basically, they used that fire to begin the social welfare system that we know today.
So the word reformer took on different meanings depending on whether you were pro-Tammany Hall or anti-Tammany Hall.
Well, you know, there is this argument that a reformer is, in fact, a regular dying to get into power. And I think that one of the things you will see in this book is that there's a lot of truth in that there were Tammany reformers. There were reformers who actually wanted regression.
Well, Teddy Roosevelt was a New Yorker, by the way, was president, and he was a serious reformer, but he had nothing to do with Tammany Hall.
No, but
he's a Republican.
He's a Republican. He was certainly anti-Tammany, but he did have one bit of wisdom that he passed on. Any political machine, he said, any political party, rather, any political organization aspires to be a machine. And there's not necessarily anything wrong with that as long as the machine is used for, you know, good causes rather than bad.
Now, you mentioned Al Smith. Al Smith came out of Tammany, and many people think he would have made a great president, but he was a Catholic. And even when John F. Kennedy ran for president, there was an awful lot of anti-Catholic talk. People asked him if the Pope told him to do something, whether he would do it or not. Was Al Smith just a victim of anti-Catholic bias?
Do you know, there certainly was a great deal of that. The presidential election of 1928, which is when he ran against Herbert Hoover, is certainly one of the ugliest presidential campaigns of all time. Barack Obama did not have to put up with the sort of public hatred that Al Smith had to put up with. But at the end of the day, the 1920s were a very, you know, prosperous time. Of course, it was a false prosperity. I don't think Al Smith was ever going to win that election.
But if he had, wouldn't he have suffered through the stock market crash instead of Herbert Hoover?
Al Smith would be.
I mean, it was inevitable, wasn't it?
It was inevitable. Al Smith would not have been able to drag the country out of the Depression any more than Herbert Hoover could.
And after the crash of 29, new scrutiny was directed on Tammany. Who were the players there?
Well, the players were Franklin Roosevelt, who became governor when Smith gave up the governor's seat to run for president in 1928. This is his great comeback. This is Franklin Roosevelt's, you know, great moment where he, you know, of course, he has polio. He didn't think he was ready to run for governor in 1928. Smith talked him into it. He wins, but barely. Al Smith lost New York in the 1928 presidential election.
And he lost his own state.
He lost his own state, probably because of an upstate prohibition vote. Smith was a wet, as we said. He was against prohibition. But the mayor of New York was Jimmy Walker, and whose clubhouse was right around the corner from where we are right now. And Walker was a great mayor for the 1920s, the Roaring Twenties. You know, he was the man about town.
Well, Gentleman Jim.
Gentleman Jim. But all of a sudden, those charms were lost when all of a sudden there were breadlines and times were bad.
But he also was a rather corrupt figure. Should we assume that anybody who came out of Tammany on some level was a bit corrupt?
Al Smith was not. Robert Wagner was not. Jeremiah Mahoney, who ran against LaGuardia in 1937, was not. I think the list of prominent Tammany people who are not corrupt, I think, is larger. I think most of those ward healers that we hear about, those minor officials whose names no one knows, I don't think they were corrupt. I think they enjoyed politics.
It sounds kind of similar to the way Chicago politics was conducted. Was were a bunch of organizations developing with similar ideas, or was Tammany Hall being imitated throughout the country?
I think that in the places
you
where
had Kansas City
you
as
had
well.
Kansas City, of course, the Pendergast machine, which produces Harry Truman, the Boston machine. Well, there was really no Boston machine. There was the Fitzgerald machine, and there was the Curley machine. But wherever the immigrants wound up in the 19th century, you did see the rise of these urban political organizations that we know of today as machines, and they were dominated by the Irish. I mean, it's. There's no question about that. They had different means. They had different methods. But I think at the end of the day, I think that they were all pretty similar.
They were dominated by the Irish. But did the Irish then embrace the other newer immigrant groups, or did they see them as a threat?
A little bit of both. Here in New York, there's the Tammany courted the Jews. And I think there's a wonderful book to be done, a complex book about Tammany's relations with Jews. I sort of touch on it in my own. In 1880, when Tammany nominated the first Irish Catholic to become mayor, William R. Grace, the New York Times and New York Tribune ran these campaigns questioning his citizenship because he was an immigrant.
He was born in Kenya, right?
Exactly. And then, suggesting the day before the election, New York Times editorial said that New York voters have a choice between an Irish Catholic of dubious citizenship or an American Protestant. And it was pretty clear who they favored. But that day, there was a rally on the Lower East Side of Jews led by Judge Cardozo's father, in which Cardozo said, don't let them do this to the Catholics, because if they do it to the Catholics, they're going to do it to us. So I think there was a great affinity between Tammany and many Jewish immigrants and children of immigrants.
My guest is Terry Galway. His book, Machine Made, Tammany Hall and the Creation of Modern American Politics, is published by LiveRight. Tammany didn't come through in the way one might have expected during the Great Depression. Why?
It was losing power. There's no, it had lost the mayoralty in 1933. Of course, the Depression was well underway then.
And then Charlie Murphy died.
Charlie Murphy died even before that. I think that there was very weak leadership. And I think, too, of course, once Franklin Roosevelt becomes president and LaGuardia becomes mayor, Tammany has no patronage and no power. And frankly, that is the beginning of the end of Tammany and is not a necessarily uplifting story.
Although you might expect Fiorello LaGuardia to have a soft spot for Tammany because he was a populist and Tammany, to some degree, was a populist organization.
Fiorello LaGuardia later on in his, I believe it was later on in his second term, it might have been his third term, appointed Jimmy Walker, who resigned in disgrace in 1932, appointed him to a city job. I think that Fiorello LaGuardia was the puzzle Tammany couldn't figure out, because by his resume and by his style, he should have been one of them.
On the other hand, his big thing was fighting corruption.
Correct.
And Tammany was almost represented corruption.
Right. But, in the early 20s, there was in New York, when the country was about to pass the immigration restrictions of 1924, these deeply racist National Origins Act, Fiorello LaGuardia was on the same stage as several Tammany congressmen united in their opposition to these immigration restrictions.
Was one of the problems that Tammany never found someone as good as Charlie Murphy to run the organization?
Absolutely. Many people, Jimmy Walker himself had said that the brains of Tammany are in Calvary Cemetery, which is where Murphy was laid to rest in 1924. And without that strong leader and a strong vision, I think that Tammany was doomed the minute the Depression hit.
The last Tammany Hall was sold to the International Ladies' Garment Workers Union.
In 1943.
Was that just a coincidence? Because that was a very liberal union.
It was. I think that the Garment Workers Union actually got a chuckle out of being able to, because they were opposed to Tammany. So I think that they sort of enjoyed the fact that Tammany by that point was literally bankrupt and they came in and bought their building.
Still, when I was a kid, Tammany Hall still meant something. And I mentioned Carmine DiSapio. He was considered a pretty powerful political boss and a kingmaker. So Tammany continued until after he died.
Well,
he didn't, not after he died.
Right.
He died Not that long ago. 2004 or something like that. He was 95 years old.
Right. Tammany's story really ends in the early 60s with the rise of Ed Koch and Manny Ornstein and William Fitzryan, these and other reformers who in the early 60s ousted DeSapio. I mean, the ultimate disgrace was that Carmine DeSapio lost his election as from his own district to Ed Koch in either 61 or 62. And by then, you know, the organization was done.
Well, I do remember an op-ed piece in the Times somewhere around that time in which a writer said that corruption or whatever word he used kind of greases the wheels of politics. And that, to some degree, was the justification for Tammany in many people's minds.
It was. And, of course, it also depends on what you think of as corruption. Patronage is not necessarily corrupt. When reformers loathe the idea that Al Smith got his first job as a grade school dropout by going into the saloon of Tom Foley and getting a job with no qualifications, but you could make the argument that that was rough sort of social justice.
Can you make the argument for the subtitle, The Creation of Modern American Politics?
Certainly the modern American Democratic Party is what Tammany became in the 19-teens and 1920s, a pluralistic, you know, gorgeous mosaic, which was not the way politics was in America in the 19th century.
So Tammany also represented liberal politics in
I believe New York? So. I believe so.
Terry Galway will be at the Midtown Manhattan Branch Library on June 9th at 6:30 to give a talk. He'll also be at the New York Athletic Club. The New York Athletic Club, I would assume, would have been opposed to Tammany throughout much of its history. That's at 6:30 on June 11th as part of their author series. And if you want more information on that, you can go to our show page at wnyc.org. There's no Tammany Hall anymore.
The building is there. It's now a theater. I think there's some poetry there, but it was declared a New York City landmark just last year.
Terry Galway's book is Machine Made, Tammany Hall and the Creation of Modern American Politics. It's published by Liveright. Terry, thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you.
It's always a pleasure having you here.